I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 83 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra's journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Leandra Lynn of the Rocky Horror Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Welcome back yourself. I'm happy that you are back and that we can get more talking into our favorite Christmas movie.
Yes, I wouldn't necessarily say it's my favorite Christmas movie, but that's just because I'm Jewish, so I don't really have favorite Christmas movies, but it's a movie that I love. But that is fine. I can appreciate that. Let's put it that way.
I don't know. I'm Jewish too, and I love Christmas movies. But I'm okay. I'm one of those people that gets like very excited about the commercialism of Christmas and just the gaudiness. So
okay, all right, no, that's fair. That's fair. I never think of what movies are, you know, are part of my favorite Christmas movies. You know, that type of thing. It's for me, I love movies, so it doesn't. I don't try and categorize them by holidays.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay, so Minute 83 begins with George giving a handout and ends with George closing yet another door. So we ended things yesterday with George helping Violet find a new way out, I guess you can say. Try to find a way for her to move along with her life. We discussed a little bit yesterday where how we're not really sure what is the main reason that she wants to leave this life. We give a few possible reasons, but we'll have to wait and see, because the movie never really tells us. So Violet, at the beginning of this minute, she basically says to George that she doesn't want him to give her the money. And he goes, "Here now, you're broke, aren't you?" Because you can see that he's doing whatever he can to really help her from a pure perspective.
Absolutely. He's doing the friendly thing. And I think that she really does come to this from a place of genuinely needing the help. I do wonder what would happen if she had said, "No, I don't want your money." And George went, "Oh, okay." And just put it back in his pocket. Like, would she go, on second thought?
Right. But again, she came there to help him and ask for his advice. So, you know, she assumed that he was going to give her money. What else, you know?
Right.
You know, "I want to leave town. I need to start over." So what is he going to say? "Okay, I'll drive you." Is that what she's looking for? You know, what other type of help could she theoretically be looking for?
Absolutely.
So it must be that she's looking for, I don't know if you want to call it a handout, but she's looking for, for funds to be able to help her along the way.
And she's come to the right place because in addition to this being a bank with good standing, she is in good standing with the president of it. So this is, I don't think that she would have been able to get a loan from maybe a conventional means outside of this.
Correct. Because you have to bring some sort of collateral. You know, here he doesn't need collateral, or she doesn't need collateral in order to be able to get the money from him. You know, and then basically she says, "I know, but, you know," because George knows that she's broke. That's a, you know, he had said to her, "Here now, you're broke, aren't you?" And she says, "I know, but," and he goes, "What do you want to do? Huck your furs in that hat? What, do you want to walk to New York? You know, they charge for meals and rent up there just the same as they do in Bedford Falls." Yeah, sure. So again, he's basically given her, a life lesson here. He's saying to her, you don't have any money. You want to keep looking as well as nice as you're looking, so you got to take my money, because without the money that I have to give you, you're not going to be able to survive, because you have to pay rent, and you have to find a way to get to New York, and you got to pay for food and things like that, just like you do here. What he doesn't say is well, here in Bedford Falls, it's been easy for you to get all that stuff, but apparently, in New York, she would have to start from scratch, finding a way to I guess to find someone to finance her.
And I think that George is incredibly polite in expressing that without saying that.
Right, but that's who George is, and in the same way, that's who Violet is. I mean, we've known Violet for many years now, and one of her first lines in the movie is "What's wrong with liking a lot of boys?" So already then we get an idea as to what direction Violet's life seems to be taking, and it's possible that there are all these other boys and men that have taken advantage of her over the years, but she's always known that George Bailey is not one of them.
Because George is one of the most upstanding, kind people in this entire town,
Right.
Bedford Falls.
Do you think she feels that she made a mistake and should have gone after George?
I would like to think that she knows that that just never would have worked out. She's too different a person than what George would have wanted. And she's not the type of woman who wants to be a housewife.
Correct. Okay, that's true. And again, I mean, George did proposition her, back before he showed up at Mary's, and everything that he suggested to her that they go do were things that just reviled her.
And
She doesn't want to
she
go walking
probably
around
stomached
barefoot.
that.
That's right. She doesn't want to go walk around barefoot. She wants to doesn't want to go skinny dipping. What the irony is that she, we discussed it at the time. She basically was implying to George, you're someone who just reads about things. I'll help you experience them, and it sounds as if, based on what she was saying there, she was talking more about a physical relationship than anything else. But George, on the other hand, was somewhat clueless about it on the on about the fact that that's what she was inferring to. But beyond that, I mean, you'd think that someone like that wouldn't have a problem going skinny dipping if that's what he was offering.
You'd think, but it's just kind of, I think that the whole package of doing these fun, kind of harmless, innocent things means that even the skinny dipping isn't quite the sultry, seductive sort of experience that Violet might enjoy more.
Right. He's able to convince her basically that she should take the money, and she says, "Oh yeah, sure." He says, "No, that's a loan now. That's my business, building a loan. Besides, you'll get a job. Good luck to you." So he, one of the great things about George is George has faith in everybody. He truly has faith in Violet, and it knows that she'll be able to get out of this rut. She'll be able to start over. She'll be able to make money back, by finding a regular job, and when she has the money, she'll pay him back, which in some ways is a mirror of what he was doing during the Depression, when he was handing out his money and telling people that I'm just giving you more loans. You're not closing your account or anything like that. So it says so much about who George Bailey is and who his character is. And I love that they keep doing that over and over throughout the course of the movie to make us realize this.
It's really interesting that in this minute in particular, you're seeing that side of George Bailey, and I would say that it's toward the end of this minute, where you start seeing a different side of him altogether.
Correct. That's right. And she responds very nicely and says, "I'm glad I know you, George Bailey." And then gives him a kiss on the cheek, and you can immediately notice that she's got lipstick on him. And he says, "Well, say hello to New York for me." Yeah, sure, I will. Now let me hear from you once in a while. Merry Christmas, Vi. Merry Christmas, George." And at this point, she turns over and realizes that she had given him, that he has a lipstick stain, I guess you could say, on his cheek, that she takes out a handkerchief and rubs it off. But she does it in front of everybody, which, is a little too public for something like this to be happening, because then people really could get the wrong impression.
And the only person who doesn't realize that is George.
That's right. Because it goes back to the fact that George is oblivious about these things, because he has pure thoughts. He doesn't even go into the possibility of possibly getting making a mistake here with this.
Exactly.
I love the fact that we can see what time it is as, when she kisses him. So we see the clock in the background says it is 10:15 in the morning. So this gives us an idea as to what's going on and when this is taking place.
Yeah, they have the entire day for things to go super well, we would hope.
Correct. Right. And then Eustace and Tilly see that she's wiping the kiss mark off of him. And at the same time, Mr. Carter, the bank examiner, or I should say Leandra Lynn, comes out of the room and stares at George and looks a little annoyed, because he does need to get to Elmira in order to spend Christmas Eve with the family.
And think about this entire exchange from the bank examiner's point of view. Mr. Carter walks in and just immediately starts getting put to the side. It seems like George keeps getting distracted, and now he's instead of getting the books, George has just spent some time with this incredibly gaudy looking woman, and everything continues to paint just the wrong picture for the bank examiner, who I think is quickly losing patience.
Yeah, well, because again, he's got to leave already. We tried figuring out last week how far it is to Elmira, but since we don't know where Bedford Falls exactly is, it's a little more difficult to figure that out.
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in upstate New York, I
For
think.
sure, it's in upstate New York, and so is Elmira, but that doesn't help us because you can't figure out how to get from point A to point B if you don't know where point A specifically is,
Exactly.
especially since it's a fictional town.
What?
Yeah, there is no real Bedford Falls. And then George turns to no, then at this point, Carter then says to him, "Mr. Bailey." And he goes, "Oh, Mr. Carter, I'm sorry, I'll be right with you." And then he turns to Eustace and Tilly and goes, "Uncle Billy in there?" And he goes, "Yeah, he's in his office." And he enters the office, and you see that this office is a complete mess. Both Tilly and Eustace are still like hanging around. They're interested in seeing what's going on.
And while I don't think that it's ever gotten this bad for Uncle Billy, I'm sure that they're not shocked to see that he's turned everything in his office upside down, probably because he lost something.
Right.
This isn't shocking behavior.
No, probably not. And as soon as George opens the door and he looks in and sees Uncle Billy, and he goes, "Uncle, what's going on?" "Because the bank examiner's here." And Uncle Billy goes, "He's here? Oh yeah. He wants the accounts payable. What's the matter with you? Come here, come here." And he like motions for him to come into the room. He wants to tell him something. It's important. He doesn't really know what's gonna. It also says a lot about Billy that as soon as he sees George, he's willing to basically tell George the, you know, what he's willing to tell George what just happened. He doesn't want to keep it a secret from George. It would be much easier for him to just keep it a secret for now.
Which I think really speaks to the fact that George probably isn't going to be super shocked about this and is likely to be able to help him.
Well, I think that's what Billy is counting on. There isn't much else to do.
Right.
But what theoretically would have happened if Uncle Billy wouldn't have told him? And let's just wait until after Christmas, and at that point we'll figure it out.
I I can't even imagine how much worse things would have been if they didn't try to immediately fix this. It never even occurred to me, but you're right. That is at least an option that Billy might have considered.
But again, he, as much as Billy has been in this business for longer than George, he knows that he can trust George to try to deal with the situation and to help things out. So, I mean, it again, it says a lot about Billy, the fact that, he's willing to keep his nephew in the loop because he knows that his nephew is the one who's the only one who's going to be able to help him here because he screwed up. No question, as far as he's concerned. Which
He's
again,
just
as far
hopeful
as
that it's not going to ruin their lives.
right, exactly. I mean, come on, what's $350,000between people? That's not a big deal at all. I mean, again, it still floors me that the value of $8,000, at that time is something that George trusted Uncle Billy with. I keep coming back to this because it just doesn't make any sense to me.
It's so shocking. It really is. It's just mind-boggling that somebody would go, oh, this person has a pet crow and other weird pets and is completely flighty and forgets things all the time. Let's give them money that they have to be in charge of.
Oh no! So I wouldn't go so far as to say because of the animals,
No,
So
it's just.
you just give money to Dr. Doolittle. You can do that, but still, the idea is that George knows that Uncle Billy has a memory issue.
I think that the animals speak to it being like Billy isn't necessarily the most mature of people. He's kind of a silly person who does eccentric things. And because of that, that's why I was throwing that in as yet another reason that if I were George, I would look at Billy as maybe not the first person on my list for taking care of the deposit.
Right. Okay. All right. I can hear that. I definitely can hear that. I guess it was needed for the
And I'm happy that it was in there,
plot. Yeah.
of course.
Yes. Well, because it helps things move along nicely with the way that it goes. Okay. So I have nothing else to say about this minute. Do you have anything else you want to say about the minute?
Nope, that about does it.
Okay. So every Wednesday we have a segment called "It's a Wonderful Wednesday," which the idea of this segment is that over the past 77 years since this movie came out, the premise or the idea behind this movie has been taken and used so many times in so many different venues. And so what I do is every week I will focus on a different one because they all have different ways of how It's a Wonderful Life has been dealt with in their particular forum. Sometimes it could be that they take the actual idea from this movie where what would life be like for the rest of the characters if one of the characters never existed. Sometimes it's just an alternate universe, different things like that. But this time I decided that I'm going to once again revisit Saturday Night Live. Months ago we talked about the Saturday Night Live lost ending sketch of It's a Wonderful Life where they get revenge on Mr. Potter. This time we're gonna talk about an episode from 1989, or sorry, it came out on May 12th, 1990. It was the 89-90 season where the host was Andrew Dice Clay, who was quite popular at that time. And but because of Andrew Dice Clay's verbal comedy, so one of the main actors in Saturday Night Live, Nora Dunn, and the musical guest Sinead O'Connor refused to be part of a show that Andrew Dice Clay will be the host of. So the opening skit of this particular episode, and I was able to find it on YouTube, is basically, what would life be like if Andrew Dice Clay was never born, so therefore he couldn't host this episode of Saturday Night Live. And his Clarence through this skit is John Lovitz, who's in a devil costume the entire time.
That is amazing.
Yes, so they take him to, you know, the alternate universe where Andrew Dice Clay doesn't exist, and they decided instead to have Frank Zappa host the show, and apparently the ratings were so bad that the show eventually got canceled because Zappa just went on and on during the opening monologue. Then they did some pretty interesting things. They killed off Nora Dunn. They say that she was crushed under one of Sinead O'Connor's amplifiers, you know, while they were setting things up. And that Sinead O'Connor was so traumatized that she gave up singing. And they bring a few other examples of things, but most of them are just throwaway jokes. But the bottom line is this was right before the Andrew Dice Clay's feature film was coming out, The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. Which, you know, friends of the show, Jay and Mark, you know, do Rennie Harlan adjacent reviews. They talked about The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. And so he actually finds out from the devil, played by John Lovitz, that this movie, Adventures of Ford Fairlane, was a smashing hit. And it made a star out of it, out of its lead actor, John Lovitz, who's actually the same guy who was playing the Clarence. And at this point, Dice Clay just starts screaming, "I want to live! I want to live!" And then Lovett screams, "Why from New York? It's Saturday night." So I think it's a fun way to look at the whole thing, especially since, you know, this is something that they pretty much did, you know, very close to making the show. I mean, we all know that Saturday Night Live skits, some of them, they, you know, they let them, you know, cook or boil for a while before they actually use them. But here they took something from the actual week, you know, that there were, you know, you have another cast member and the original musical guest that refused to be on the show. And they decided to just poke fun at that. And I think that, you know, you got to give them a lot of credit for wanting to do, for being willing to do something like that.
I'm a big fan of lampshading, so this was this sounds like it was very effective for kind of explaining some of the some of what happened behind the scenes without it being the major takeaway.
Right.
And I love the concept of, honestly, I love anything that John Lovitz is in. So this sounds hilarious.
Yes. So I'm assuming that means you're familiar with Hanukkah Harry, if that's the case.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
How could I not be?
Yeah, exactly. That's it's one of it's among my favorite skits. It's a great it's a great skit because it you know, they know how to make things just super super funny the way that I'm actually curious. I wonder if there's any place where you can even figure it out. You know, how Nora Dunn reacted to the fact that they did this.
Oh, that's a good call.
You know, because she continued to be on the show. I mean, it wasn't that she left the show completely. She just refused to be on that particular episode. So that thing that really makes me wonder, you know, whether, you know, right. I mean, according to IMDb, so Nora Dunn was scheduled musical guest Sinead O'Connor boycotted this episode in protest of host Andrew Dice Clay's jokes about women. Julie Cruz was quickly hired to replace O'Connor, and Dunn was fired at the end of the season. Interesting. I wonder if they fired her because of that or not.
I mean, I'm sure that it had to do with it because they don't want to have people in that they're expecting to use every single week that have their own opinions of how they should be used.
Right. That's true. Oh, this is actually also interesting. So both David Spade and Rob Schneider made their first appearances on this particular episode. David Spade actually played Michael J. Fox in a segment that they did. And he was supposed to get credit, but they, for some reason, didn't give him credit. And everyone thought that it was Dana Carvey who played the, who
oh,
did
no.
the Michael J. Fox impression. So that's pretty funny also. So, yeah. What can you do? But yeah, so I see now that I know that Nora Dunn was fired, it makes me wonder if she was fired because of this, or if they had other reasons to get rid of her. Because I always, I mean, for me, late 80s Saturday Night Live is some of the best ones that they had, you know. So it's interesting to know what happened with whether that was the reason why she got kicked out or not. But oh well. We'll never know. Another thing that we'll never know. So, Leandra, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Absolutely. You can find me at rockyhorrorminute.com or any place that you get your podcast by searching Rocky Horror Minute.
All right. And I think this is actually a great time to also mention to people that you can go to the Movies by Minute website. There are currently, as of recording, 241 different Movies by Minute podcasts that are listed there. I'm sure if you go there, you can find other movies that you might be interested in hearing what people, crazy people like us, think about about the movie minute by minute. And if for some reason you don't see your favorite movie on that list, you can go in and create your own podcast. We have a great online community on Facebook where people are very helpful. And I got help from people when I started. And look at where I am now, 6 seasons later, still doing it, and still getting advice from people in the group there too. So anyone who's interested, I strongly recommend that you go and check it out. And like I said, if you want to start your own, there's tips on the site, and many of us are willing to help out whenever possible.
Yeah, if you start a podcast, definitely let me know and I'll gladly guest on it.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Route Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movieroutminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot
I
dog.
love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow. Life with its tears.